It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Eau Claire has become known around the country as a musical hotspot, and that reputation was a long time in the making. We'll find out about a new project gathering stories about Eau Claire's musical history. First, Governor Walker is calling on lawmakers to hold a special session to pass legislation on school safety. The governor's proposed plan includes 7 items, including a $100 million grant program, establishing an Office of School Safety under the State Department of Justice, mandatory reporting of threats of violence at schools, and more. The governor and lawmakers are pursuing these school safety measures in the aftermath of the mass shooting at a high school in Parkland, Florida last month. Critics of the governor's plan say it doesn't go far enough, and the proposed package ignores concerns from many students. Democrats unveiled their own school safety proposals earlier this week as well. Sean Johnson is the Capitol Bureau Chief for Wisconsin Public Radio News. Sean, welcome back.
Hey, Rob.
Well, talk us through, first of all, what the governor is calling for here.
I think the biggest thing far and away in the governor's proposal is $100 million in state funding for school security measures. We don't know exactly what that would look like yet, but we do know $100 million in state funding, the broad strokes, that's a substantial amount, especially at the end of a legislative session. This is not something that's in the thick of a budget. It's potentially spending down the state's reserves when there are, other competing priorities out there.
And this would be as a grant, at least as initially proposed. This could change in the legislature, but schools would come up with their own security needs, I guess, and apply for this?
Yeah. So, exactly. I mean, schools who wanted to do this, who wanted to add security measures at their school buildings, for example, would apply to the state. The state would have this $100 pot of money and would decide who gets it. And nobody's quite sure whether that $100 million would cover what everybody wants. You know, if all the schools proposed projects, would everything be funded under this? But the Wisconsin Association of School Boards, for example, is in support of this. They say that it's, that's not an insignificant number.
Mm-hmm. And there are other measures, including some things related to bullying, training staff in trauma-informed care. Some things not directly related to security per se.
Yeah, just, really spelling out in state law when a bullying incident gets reported or any threats of school violence, spelling out how that gets reported, more specifics there. But they're much smaller measures than, the $100 million that he's proposing.
And what have Democrats been saying about the plan?
Far and away, the response seems to be that you have the governor calling this school safety special session of the legislature and that there's nothing in there that would restrict guns, which is what, for example, the thousands of students that came to the Wisconsin Capitol and students that rallied all over the country yesterday are calling for. They want restrictions to gun purchases like universal background checks. They were calling for in Wisconsin raising the minimum age for purchasing a firearm from 18 to 21, banning bump stocks that were used in the Las Vegas shooting that make it easier to fire off, lots of rounds at once. That's not in the governor's plan. It's really focused specifically on giving schools money that they are asking for to make school buildings more secure.
And we heard earlier in the week from some Democrats with their own proposals. There's some overlap. They were calling for school security funding, as the governor is. What other kind of things were on their agenda?
Yeah, there is overlap, because the Democratic plan would have would let local school districts pursue these school safety measures using local property tax dollars. And under a proposal by State Superintendent of Public Instruction Tony Evers, that would be reimbursed by state government. So it's just a kind of a different funding mechanism to get there. Actually, when Governor Walker became governor, there was something in state law that lets local school districts exceed local revenue limits to pay for school safety. And Walker got rid of that in his first budget. That's something that did and have the prospect to increase property taxes at the local level. It used to be law. That's something that he got rid of.
Talking to Sean Johnson, WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief, looking at school safety measures proposed by the governor and by Democrats, the governor calling now for a special session. The key players here in making something happen are not the governor or Democrats in the legislature, but Republicans who have the majority in both chambers. What are we hearing from them?
So it sounds like maybe, you know, a lot of the stuff that we've talked about in recent weeks, months, years of infighting between the chambers with Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald and Assembly Speaker Robin Voss could come into play on this issue, too. Voss was out there pretty soon after the governor called for his special session and said, the Assembly supports this plan. We're going to be in special session for one day next week, and we're going to pass this. And it was a pretty simple statement. Didn't tell us which day they're going to be in there, but everything else basically sounded like we're going to give the governor what he wants here, and we're going to go home. The Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald issued a statement that left it a little bit more to doubt. He said that, you know, he talked to members of his caucus about this and that they're working on legislation that they want to pass in regular session next week. That could be an important distinction. Says he's fully supportive of what the governor announced and that the Senate Republican proposal will, quote, closely align with the governor's objectives.
So the two chambers have to pass something that doesn't closely align. It has to ultimately be the same thing.
Yeah, I mean, here's the thing. If they both pass very similar bills, they could both potentially go home and say that they voted for school safety funding, but nothing would become law. And that goes for everything that we talk about over the next week as they look to wrap up their business for 2018. They can both pass different versions of the same bill, but if it's not identical, it can't become law. And, you know, Fitzgerald's statement here raises the prospect, at least, that that could happen with the governor's school safety plan.
Now, in regular order, or whatever it's called at the state legislative level, usually there'd be public hearings on something like this, right? It wouldn't be proposed this week, voted on next week.
They can call public hearings pretty quickly, and I'm not sure when they'd be. The speaker's office didn't say exactly, you know, didn't say that they wouldn't have a public hearing, but they could have a public hearing one day, voted on in the legislature the next day. You know, they can move pretty fast when they want to in the legislature. We just don't know yet.
So this procedural potentially wrangling, I mean, with an issue like school safety, do you think they'll be able to overcome some of the personal animosity and friction that's been there?
I don't know. I mean, I feel like we wouldn't probably have this discussion if it weren't for the fact that Fitzgerald's statement there raises the prospect that it could happen again. I mean, there's a lot going on in these closing days where Senate Republicans want to do something slightly different than Assembly Republicans, but it's kind of like a legislative game of chicken over who's going to veer from their course and, you know, who's going to be willing to change the plan or not. Assembly Republicans have said they're done with their regular session business for the year. Senate Republicans have said they got to come back.
One item that's not in the governor's proposal is the idea of arming teachers or school staff in some way selectively. The president has talked about this idea. Others around the country have. That's not right now on the table here in Wisconsin.
It is not. So you have pretty much, at least in Wisconsin, among decision makers in state government, that is not something that's supported. You have had the state attorney general, Brad Schimmel, come out and say that he was open to arming teachers in schools, maybe. So he's not closed the door on that. And he would be, by the way, in charge of this new Office of School Safety. It would report to the Wisconsin Department of Justice, not to the Department of Public Instruction. But I don't believe that would give him the authority to say school safety in Wisconsin means armed teachers. I believe that would take a change in state law.
One other thing not in the governor's proposal, and I've seen some reaction from Democrats critical of this, not increasing funding for things like school social workers and mental health specialists.
Yeah, I mean, that's something also that Tony Evers, state superintendent, Democratic candidate for governor. I mean, it's hard not to look one of many, but it's hard not to look at this stuff through the, you know, the lens of how would it affect the governor's race in 2018, because one of the candidates is one of the Democratic candidates is the state superintendent of public instruction. And, you know, he has business making proposals on what he thinks the state should do with his school safety. And then you have Governor Scott Walker, his potential adversary, Republican. Evers talked about that in his plan. The governor did not. Again, Walker's plan is really specifically focused on school safety funding for safety at school buildings.
So it's all up to the legislature now to wrangle this one out.
Yeah, and it's going to happen potentially pretty fast. And while some of these other ideas, like universal background checks, for example, are not in the governor's plan, and it's not something that Republican legislative leaders have given any indication that they want to do at the state level. You could see Democrats try to force procedural votes to get Republicans on the record on something like that. They point to that recent Marquette poll, among others, showing that 80%+ of Wisconsin residents favor something like universal background checks, even though this is a state where a lot of people, a lot of households own guns.
Sean, thanks a lot for joining us.
You're welcome.
That's Sean Johnson, Capitol Bureau Chief for Wisconsin Public Radio News. He joined us today to talk about both Governor Walker's proposed school safety plan and a separate plan from Democratic lawmakers. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret, and we're hearing Howard Guitar Ludke, one of the many great musicians from Eau Claire's musical history. The city has become known nationwide as the hometown of Justin Vernon, frontman for the band Bon Iver, but the area has had a rich and long musical scene for decades, and a new project is making sure that musical history gets preserved. Faculty and students at UW-Eau Claire held a history harvest earlier this month, inviting people to bring in documents, instruments, or just their own stories about music in the city. They'll be part of a digital archive and a series of new podcasts that are in the works. Dan Ott is leading the project. He's a visiting assistant professor of history at UW-Eau Claire. Dan, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, Dan, what led you and others there into this project to dig into Eau Claire's musical history?
I came to Eau Claire as a public historian, and the key thing that we do is we try to figure out what sort of history is relevant to the community that we're in and try and do projects that focus on that and get our students doing projects that are about history that people care about. And so the city of Eau Claire is going through sort of a musical moment probably in the last 5 years, really since Bon Iver, Justin Vernon, won a Grammy in 2012 and publicly thanked Eau Claire on national television. The city is sort of unified behind this idea of it being a music destination and having a musical culture. And so we decided to sort of dig into that because people in the community of Eau Claire, businesses, the university, nonprofits, the municipality, are very, very interested in music here. And so we're trying to figure out, you know, where did this come from and what are its dimensions and what are its roots?
Well, as you're learning more and more, that history, I guess, goes way back before 2012. Can you talk about Eau Claire's musical heritage a little bit?
I think that there's probably a couple of layers that we need to think about when we think about music in Eau Claire. The first one is not that unique to Eau Claire particularly, but just sort of the upper Midwest, that we have a lot of different cultural traditions associated with music, going back to indigenous communities like the Ojibwe, but also including old stock Europeans, Germans, Czechs, Scandinavians who moved to the area, right? So you sort of start with that base layer and then add on top of that a University of Wisconsin school, or it started off as a normal school for teacher education at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire today, but it started 100 years ago in 1916, really focusing on teacher education and musical education as a part of that. So that's sort of one of these really, really important threads in this, is the development of that of our school and also the ways in which it supports music and has really cultivated a musical community among students, as well as creating a really, really top-notch musical department and music program, teacher education, jazz, classics, symphony, whatever, that has been around for quite some time. So that's sort of the second layer. And the third layer is that we have an interesting intersection with popular music starting in the 1950s and 1960s as a result of I-94 going by, very close by, or through Eau Claire, and providing us with a nice stopping spot for big-name musicians and bands on their way between Chicago and Minneapolis. And so they would stop over, and you'd have people like Buddy Holly played in 1959 in Eau Claire. Frank Zappa played in the 1970s. A whole Ike and Tina Turner played there, right? So we have this interesting sort of more intimate experience in very, very small venues going back to the 1960s and 1970s with sort of national popular music that sort of, I think, in some ways gave people in Eau Claire a different experience than most of the nation had, because they're able to have this direct and intimate interaction in small venues that other people usually would just have at large venues or over the radio or on their LPs and their record table, their record player, right? So those are sort of the three major things that, sort of cultivated an interesting musical heritage in this area. And then you sort of combine that with the more recent emergence of Bon Iver and the community getting behind this idea of a musical identity to sort of create a unique musical moment in the city as it's sort of trying to reinvent itself and has been since the decline of manufacturing in the 1990s and really has settled on music as the way forward along with education, healthcare, and technology as where the future of the city is going to be.
Public historian Dan Ott is with us. He's a visiting assistant professor of history at UW-Eau Claire. We're talking about a project he's working on with students there and community members trying to dig up the musical history, the longstanding musical history of Eau Claire. And Dan, let's get into that project now. You had people harvesting various kinds of things. What kind of things are you looking for?
Well, we really didn't know what we were going to find. We just knew that we didn't have much of a collection in terms of artifacts or papers related to music in the region, but we knew it was important. And so we really invited literally anyone to come in. We promoted it widely, newspapers, radio, this kind of thing, word of mouth, to have people come in and share what they had, stories, artifacts, whatever, to walk in the door. And so what we found when we had this event on March 3rd at the Chippewa Valley Museum, we found just a real interesting breadth. So at the oldest end of things, we got an 1880s fiddle that walked in the door. A gentleman had recently acquired it from his family. It had been his great-great-grandfather's who had played this fiddle in a logging camp.
Wow.
Right? And then to give you sort of the other end of the spectrum, we had a guy named Nate Sorensen come in and share his collection of posters and memorabilia from running a hardcore and punk rock show in his mom's basement for 11 years called Nate's Dungeon. Right? So it gives you a broad tapestry of musical history in the area. And, you know, in between we wound up with a lot of scrapbooks from decades-old community singing community organizations like the Master Singers and the Male Chorus, sharing sort of this rich history of community engagement in the arts. We had people bring in scrapbooks from the 1950s related to Dixieland jazz festivals. A lot of people who are long-term musicians in the area tell their stories about where they used to gig and who they used to play with and what sort of things were popular at any given time. So we really saw this broad cross-section of musical interests come through the doorway, which was really fantastic for me. We had no idea, and it was elating for my students who really were, you know, I told them that we were going to do this thing, and they were like, well, what's going to happen? And, you know, people responded. We had about 200 people show up at the event. About 40 people actually had the opportunity to contribute objects. So we wound up with about 3,000 items that we wind up digitizing, which we are preserving at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire Special Collection and Archive, and we're also going to create an online exhibit component of this so that people can page through the stuff that the community provided and hopefully get some good insight into the deeper roots of the musical moment in Eau Claire and the Chippewa Valley.
And Dan, I understand you're going to get some podcasts out of this as well.
Yeah, so we started this collaboration. This project, the Sounds of Eau Claire project, started about a year ago as an oral history project. And we started by doing about 11 the first semester and then 13 oral histories the following semester after that in collaboration with the local radio station, Blue Gold Radio, which is a partnership with the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire and the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire Foundation. And my students then had the opportunity to take these oral histories and produce them into radio segments, sort of highlighting the best parts of hour and a half long oral histories.
What kind of stories are you hearing?
Well, the stories that we wind up hearing are really... It sort of varies based on what we ask. So we had stories about, we talked to a guy named Jim Bischel, who was responsible for founding Country Jam, and Larry Barr, who's also responsible for this, and they tell the stories of how they wound up getting into this sort of festival business. We heard stories from people in the University of Wisconsin Music Department telling longer histories of the jazz program, Ron Kieser and Bob Baca. We had People talk about what it's been like more recently on the music scene for the last 10 to 15 years. Jerrica Miguel sort of shared her stories about being a folk musician in Eau Claire. And we really have this great sort of breadth of experience to sort of draw on and share these stories. And it's been sort of fantastic. I'm actually really looking forward to getting to the point where we're going to make these podcasts out of these newer stuff we've gotten as well. Because we have stories about this guy brought in a 1920s bass drum that his grandfather, I believe, used to play on, as well as this entire kit, around the region at dance halls as part of a dance band. And so his family would follow along with him to these various venues, and the kids would wind up after the gig would wind up sleeping underneath the stage, right? And so you get these sort of fantastic stories about what music used to be like, because music is a very, very different experience today where we think about podcasts and the radio versus what music had been like, which was much more personal. You had to be more in the room with musicians. I mean, not so much in the 1920s, but, you know, sort of, right? You don't necessarily have the way music is accessible today is very, very different than how it used to be, and sort of the emphasis on particular artists was not as important as actually the place you would go hear a musician play a cover or play just sheet music, so you'd have the opportunity to go socialize, to go dance, to go meet people. And it's just a very, very different musical culture today than it used to be.
And sort of, just briefly, Dan, as we wrap up, if somebody's listening in the area and says, hey, I've got something I want to share, can they still do that?
Absolutely. We're actually doing a follow-up event at the University of Wisconsin on April 14th. So we're doing a overflow event because we had so many people that came in. So, yeah, if you're interested in contributing to the project, it's on April 14th from 11 to 4 at the University of Wisconsin Eau Claire Archives.
Dan, thanks a lot for joining us. Really great project.
Thank you so much, Rob. I greatly appreciate it.
That's Dan Ott, visiting assistant professor of history at UW-Eau Claire. He is leading a project to preserve the area's music history with documents, artifacts, and recorded interviews. Go out to the news with the UW-Eau Claire Jazz Ensemble. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Now, a serious illness might stop most of us from pursuing an athletic career. But our next guest decided not to let multiple sclerosis stop her and has gone farther in her sport than she ever expected. Alyssa Fensel is in her second year competing at the international level for para taekwondo, having classified for the sport in 2016. She's a registered nurse, a single parent of two kids, and a Team USA para taekwondo athlete training for a chance at competing in Tokyo in 2020. She lives and trains in Stevens Point. Alyssa, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Well, I want to set the scene. You were already doing taekwondo. You'd had two car accidents. In one of them, you found out you had MS. You had this diagnosis. Did it occur to you at that point, like, okay, maybe taekwondo is done for me?
Yeah, actually, I ended up taking a six-year hiatus from taekwondo because of recovery from the car accidents, trying to deal with the MS diagnosis. Even may have been a few years longer than that. I took a significant break because I just didn't know how my life was going to end up changing because of the diagnosis and the car accident.
And, you know, it's really easy to convince me not to do something athletic. I probably would have been done forever. What brought you back into it years later?
I decided after having a couple kids, I needed to do something to get healthier. I had had large weight gain. I was almost 300 pounds. I had previous success with taekwondo, losing weight. It was a fun social activity. Everybody's active. Everybody pushes each other. So I decided to give it a go and see what happened.
Before we talk more about taekwondo and getting back into it, can you talk about MS? I think everybody's probably heard of multiple sclerosis, but how does it affect you on a day-to-day basis?
Multiple sclerosis has a very wide range of effects on people. For me, I'm lucky it's very, very mild. If you saw me walking down the street, you wouldn't know that I had the disability or that it really affected me. For me, my symptoms are most pronounced when I overheat. I have very poor heat tolerance, so when I get too hot, fatigue sets in a lot faster. I start having some balance issues. A lot of it for me is stuff that only I can tell. When I'm doing very heavy training regimens or workouts, then towards the end, I start having trouble make my body do what I want it to do. So, you know, I want to do a certain type of kick. I have a hard time keeping my balance and actually performing that kick well.
What was it like when you first started training with, difficulty sometimes overheating, balance, and getting back into this fairly demanding activity?
Yeah, well, when I started, I was really overweight, so I didn't notice it so much because the weight and just trying to get my endurance back up really kind of masked how it is now that I can do more. My endurance is higher and I've lost 100 pounds. I can do a lot more, so I'm starting to notice it more. So like this past weekend, I did a four-hour session. We had some athletes join us from the Chicago and Milwaukee areas. And, you know, between hours 3 and 4, I was really starting to notice that I was slowing down. My reflexes weren't as good. So I just have to kind of pace myself as I need to.
You said when you got back into it, it was for health reasons, getting mm-hmm. some activity, maybe losing some weight along the way. Did you have any idea that, hey, maybe someday I'm going to compete at this?
No, I actually went to 2016 Nationals just to have the experience of competing at that level because I also coach the younger kids at the studio. So for me, it's easier to help relay things to other people if I've done it myself. I went just to do it to say I did it. Next thing I know, I'm classified to Team USA Para Taekwondo, and I have to start getting ready for international competition because I have a very real shot at Tokyo in 2020.
When did you first find out that there was a Para Taekwondo national team?
When I was at Nationals in Virginia in 2016, I was at a meeting with my coach, and they started talking about the call for athletes and looking for people. I started doing some research, saw multiple sclerosis was a classifiable diagnosis that would get me in front of the International Paralympic Committee's classifying team. And from there, they do a rigorous physical exam, and they go through your medical records. And from there, they decide if you qualify to compete or not. So I sat with the classifiers. My coach actually, he kind of laughed at me. He's like, there's no way. He actually didn't even know I had multiple sclerosis until that trip. I hadn't told him because I didn't want him to treat me any differently. So he does still give me a hard time about that. He was pretty disbelievable that it would be something we get to do. But, you know, what's the worst they can do? Tell us no. We went, and then we came back, and they told us that, yes, I did classify and to start getting ready. And it's like, okay, now we got to figure out how to do this. So we're both learning this together. It was announced in 2016 that Para Taekwondo would make its debut at the 2020 game.
It's been a long road from getting back into Taekwondo after the accidents and the diagnosis, and now you've got this 2020 deadline looking at you. How do you get from here to hopefully Japan in 2 years?
A lot of hard work. I mean, as soon as we got on the team, I started training quite heavily to make my debut on the international scene in Las Vegas, which is the U.S. Open. That was last year, 2017. And just see what happens. I went up against the number 2 seed in the world at Las Vegas and beat her 8-1. And I was actually the lowest ranked athlete, so I had a couple other matches before her. So it was quite an entrance to the scene. Had a lot of success last year. Now I'm starting my second cycle of international competition. I had my first event this year in Las Vegas for the U.S. Open again. I came home with a silver medal from that event, a gold in Pumse. When they classify us, you either get classified to sparring or Pumse, which is the forms competition. And the neurological diagnoses, such as multiple sclerosis, some of them can be classified to be able to do both. Mm-hmm. I am one of maybe six or seven in the world that is classified to both, and the only one in the world that competes in both.
What do you think you've learned about yourself through this whole experience?
Just because somebody thinks I can't or won't be able to do something doesn't mean it's true. Just that drive and determination and finding that with a lot of work and creativity and help from people around that I can do just about anything I want.
Now, the other Paralympic Games are going on. The Winter Paralympic Games are happening right now in South Korea. Anybody you're rooting for or looking at for inspiration?
You know, you root for everybody. It's one of the cool things is we're all a team. We all work together. You root for everybody. You want to see all of your teammates on Team USA do well. So as I get the reports, I've been trying to wish everybody well. It's hard to reach out to them because I don't know a lot of the winter sports athletes. I haven't had the opportunity to meet any of them yet. Hopefully that comes as I do my travels. But, you know, you want to see everybody do well. I know that's one of the kind of fun things I've noticed with the Taekwondo event is after the competition's done, all the athletes, regardless of the country they represent, get together and talk, spend some time together, translators used as necessary, so that we can all visit a little bit. We're opponents on the mat, but then building friendships when we're off the mat.
It's a good place to leave it. Alyssa, good luck over the next couple of years.
Wonderful. Thank you very much.
Alyssa Fentzel is a Team USA para taekwondo athlete. She lives and trains in Stevens Point. Now we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you do to keep active? What role does your sport or exercise or fitness activity have in your life? Is there a sport that you play or wish you could go back to playing? Maybe something you played in your childhood? Call us now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll pick up the conversation, hopefully hear from you, coming up on Central Time. Right now we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Exercise, fitness, sports can play a big part in our lives. They can give us exercise, of course, help us be healthier physically. They can also help with stress release, our mental health, and we want to hear from you. What is your activity? Is it a sport, a class, a running, whatever it might be? Let us know and tell us what role it plays in your life. What does it do for you? Are you trying to find more time for it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll go right to your calls. Thea is with us in Northeast Iowa. Thea, hi.
Hi.
What's your activity, Thea?
My activity is running.
And is that a big break from your daily life or your job?
It sure is. I'm a dairy farmer, and I take the opportunity to go running whenever I can.
And what does that do for you? Exercise, health, a good break from the job?
It's a break from the job, and it's a really big stress reliever for me.
Okay. And do you do competitive running at all or just for fun?
No, just for fun. I think competitive running would be more stress, so...
I am right there with you. Thea, thank you so much for getting us started at 800-642-1234. We asked around here at WPR. We heard from a couple of our colleagues here, Willa and Tara. They both get exercise walking their dogs. Willa says, step one, get a dog. Step two, walk the dog while doing something else you love, listening to music or a podcast or walk with a friend. Go dog park, hopping, vary the routes, and use Map My Walk app if you want to monitor speed. And then Tara here at WPR says everything she does actively is her dog. It's a high-energy breed, a cattle dog. They hike, backpack, walk, run. They've even run a half marathon together. Back to your calls now with your exercise activities and sports. Bill is with us in Wisconsin Rapids. Bill, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What's your activity, Bill?
My wife and I love to go geocaching. For those that aren't familiar with it, basically, in 30 words or less, it's an outdoor treasure hunt using your handheld GPS unit. And we've been doing that for about 14 years now. And there are geocaches hidden all over the world. We've found geocaches in Jerusalem, Moldova, Argentina.
Wow.
simply put, if you have the time, people will go hide something, be it out in the woods inside a hollow log, for example. They'll hide either a little Tupperware container or a coffee can, and they'll always have at least a pad of paper in there and a pen. And then they'll take the coordinates, the latitude and longitude, on their GPS. Then they'll go to geocaching.com, and they'll enter that new geocache that they hit. And then, okay, I'm going to be going to Eau Claire, Wisconsin next weekend. I go on to geocaching.com. I punch it up. I see what geocaches are in the area. We punch the coordinates into our unit. We go looking for it. When we find it, you don't get the some of the caches have items to trade, like Mardi Gras beads or kazoos or simple stuff. Otherwise, it's basically just the thrill of the hunt. You sign the log, then later you go back online, log the fact that you found it, and the person who owns the cache gets an email indicating that, yes, it's still out there, people are finding it. There's over 2.5 million caches around the world. My wife and I have hidden 12 of our own. We plan our vacations a lot of times around geocaching.
That's fantastic, Bill. And you're headed to Eau Claire for one. Where have you hidden some of yours, if we want to try to find yours?
If ours that we've hidden, we've gone to up near Pittsville, Wisconsin. We've got several hidden in the Wisconsin Rapids area. We did hide one out near Ryle, Wisconsin, which is on Highway 16.
Sure.
But that had to be archived because I think some critters kept getting to it and spiriting it away.
Bill, thank you so much for sharing that. We are asking for your exercise activity, your sport. What do you do to stay active at any age? Call 800-642-1234. We'll go next to Jody with us in Amory. Jody, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about, Jody?
I do para-raining to stay active.
Well, I will admit, I don't know what para-raining is.
Well, reining is a Western sport where you ride a horse in a pattern
that
in a kind show
of
ring.
Rain. Okay.
And so para stands for parallel. We are riders with disabilities, and we want to be seen as parallel to able-bodied riders. So para-riding helps us, or reining helps us keep our bodies in shape and in tone, and the competition is wonderful.
That sounds great. And talk about what goes into the competitive side of that, Jody.
Yeah, we are part of a organization called World Para Reining, and what we do is we are competing across the world. We had our international competition last year in the Netherlands, and this year it's going to be in Tryon, North Carolina. So we're Team USA. We're hoping, you know, we can get into one of the top three spots this year. Not last year, but the year before, it was in Oklahoma City, and USA took gold. That was pretty awesome. But we have everybody from, we have different grades, so grade 1 through grade 4. So it can be everybody from total wheelchair-bound, paraplegic, to people with, say, missing limbs or nerve issues. We are always welcoming new members also, but it's a great opportunity. Horses provide us with a unique way to stretch and move our muscles that we don't necessarily get to do just on our own. And for a lot of people that are wheelchair bound, they get to run again or maybe for the first time in their life.
That's fantastic. Jody, good luck in, you said Tryon, North Carolina?
Yes, sir. We will be there this year in September.
Well, best of luck to you and the team. Thank you so much for sharing that story. I appreciate it. We are asking what you do to stay active on your own, as a sport, as a team, you name it. 800-642-1234 is the number. We'll go next to Dawn with us in Spooner. Dawn, hi.
Hi. You got some interesting things going on here.
No kidding, don't we?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm a belly dancer. Actually, I should tell you, I'm a belly dancing senior citizen.
Okay. How did you get into belly dancing?
Oh, it was a fluke. I found a DVD and thought it might be fun to try it, and it made me laugh. And then I looked for people to dance with. And I have never, ever been able to, like, go to an exercise class or stick with any kind of exercise for, honestly, longer than a couple days. But I've been belly dancing for 7 years, and now I'm teaching belly dance. I have had students from age 18 to their 70s. Well, actually, I taught belly dancing at one of the local nursing homes. So I had students in the nursing home.
That sounds fun. And I'm guessing that the core strength has got to benefit a lot from the belly dancing.
Oh, my gosh. Core strength and balance. One of the things that's really, really important as you get older is maintaining your balance. And if you're dancing and maintaining that core strength and keeping your feet in shape, you've got balance. And you've got with weight-bearing exercise, so it's keeping me strong. So, yeah.
That's fantastic, Dawn. Keep at it. Thanks so much for calling in at 800-642-1234. Also from our team around here, we heard from Susanna on our membership team. She bikes to work from April through October, 30 minutes one way. Sometimes she'll take the bus, but bike a ways or walk an extra mile to the transfer point. And a few people, she and Valerie, take the 90-some stairs up and down to our floor here on Vilas. I need to do that more. I used to do that. And Dave Potraz, who you hear on the network some, he bikes or walks into work most days. They get their exercise in their commute. Back to your calls now. Herb is with us in Dubuque. Herb, hi.
Hello. How you doing?
Good. What's your exercise, Herb?
I'm a runner. I started running approximately 25 to 30 years ago. Went into the doctor's office. My numbers were up. He said, yeah, I had to do something. So I figured, okay, I want to be around for my kids. Started running. I am currently 61. I ran my first marathon at the age of 57.
Wow. And you held up okay for all, what, 26.2 miles?
Yes, I did.
How did you?
I finished in 4.5 hours, a 10.5-minute mile.
That sounds great, Herb. And you worked up to that over that 20-some-year span?
Ever so slow.
Thank you so much for sharing that. I learned something. Tom, one of our engineering guys here, he does all sorts of fitness stuff, hiking, skiing, climbing, biking, swimming, and he does triathlons. That's intense. That sounds like a lot to me. And we talked to that ultra runner, a farmer who runs, 30, 50, 100-mile races too. So we've got some extreme athletes out there. Back to your calls now. Stan is on the line in Waterloo, Iowa. Stan, hi.
How we doing?
Good. What'd you want to tell us about?
Started down in Florida about 18 months ago or so, playing pickleball down there, and brought it back up to Waterloo and started playing around Waterloo, and it's a lot of fun. Good exercise.
Pickleball. Explain for people who don't know what that is.
It's basically you take a badminton net and you lower it down to the ground, so it's a little bit shorter than a tennis net, and it's got a smaller court. And basically, you play it with a paddle instead of a racket, so it's a solid, solid paddle, and you play it with a wiffle ball.
And I'm guessing it takes a lot of running to keep up with that wiffle ball.
Yeah, a little bit. It's not quite as intensive as either racquetball or tennis, but you get some good exercise.
Sounds like a great workout, Stan. Thanks for calling. We go next to Allison in Eureka. Allison, hi.
Hi, great show.
Thanks.
I really enjoyed the para reining story. That was great.
Me too.
I did call because I do have a horse, and boy, a horse can really keep you in shape. Even just the grooming is a workout. I'm going to be 58 years old, and I've done everything from bicycling to work to cross-country skiing almost every day off. From my nursing job, but now I find so much pleasure in going to our state parks with my two dogs and hiking. We just got back from Kettle Moraine, which is muddy and a little bit snowy still in Greenbush, but we walked the 6-mile trail and ate our lunch and came home, and boy, I tell you, there's nothing like being outside, and horses and dogs will keep you outside and keep you in shape. There's no question about it.
Fantastic. Allison, thanks for your call. I've spent some time in Greenbush and at Kettle Moraine near there. I know what you're talking about. Well, thank you to everyone who called in. And you can keep sharing your favorite sport or fitness activity or exercise, you name it. Email ideas at WPR.org or share it with everybody. You can tweet us at Central Time WPR. Am I inspired enough to start getting more than my modest amounts of 10,000 steps a day? Reply hazy. Ask again later. And one more activity that's big here in Wisconsin may be getting a style upgrade, and you can make a difference. A national chain of bowling alleys is holding a national contest to design a fresh, new, stylish look for rental bowling shoes. The contest is called Be Bold. I get it now. Now that I say it out loud, like B-O-W-L-E-D, but Be Bold. As reported in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, the Bowl Arrow chain of bowling alleys is looking for your shoe designs, and it looks like the chain has one alley here in Wisconsin, in Wauwatosa. The top five designs will get a runway show on Times Square in New York City. Ultimately, the winner's designs are going to end up at the chain's bowling alleys around the country. Now, I've bowled, you know, a time or two in my life, a bunch of times, and I rent the shoes. I don't bowl enough to own my own. I'm not the most stylish person in the world. I have never felt, you know, embarrassed or ashamed that the rental bowling shoes were not stylish enough. They probably matched my clothes just fine. But I think bowling is getting cool and hip in some of the bigger cities around the country, so I could see maybe jazz it up with something a little more fashionable. Let us know what you think. Send us a picture of your bowling shoes. If you have some personalized ones, tweet it to us at Central Time WPR. You're listening to the Ideas Network.